Welcome to the Maximus Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Cam Sapa. As a clinical psychologist, medical school professor, and CEO, I specialize in helping men be better in mind, body, and masculinity. On this podcast, I interview extraordinary men as a clinician would, hearing their come-up stories of how they became the men that they are today, and having them share their secrets of actionable advice on how to look, feel, and perform your best. Awesome. Welcome everyone to the Maximus Podcast. I'm very excited today to have Jeff Wu as our guest. He is an entrepreneur and investor, well known as the co-founder and chairman of Human, which focuses on modern nutrition and applies cutting-edge research in metabolism and physiology to support your health, wellness, and performance goals. Jeff also earned a BS with honors and distinction in computer science from Stanford University. He holds 5 U.S. patents relating to material physics, software architecture, and algorithms, and is the co-author of 2 peer-reviewed science papers relating to human performance, metabolism, and physiology. He has dedicated many years of his life to finding new information on how to increase human performance and stays informed with new technological advances. I call him the Dave Asprey for millennials. And he is also an advisor and investor with Maximus. So great to get you on our podcast.
Cam, really the pleasure is mine and too kind of an introduction.
Absolutely. Well, we kind of like to do a two-part podcast. So the first part is what we call Making the Man. That's a little bit more biographical. So I'd love to kind of hear your story and kind of share that with the world in terms of, you know, your come up and how you got to where you are. And the second part, we'll talk about actionable advice. And I'm sure a lot of people would love to hear about your health and fitness routine and all the things that you do to enhance your own performance. So why don't we start at the beginning? Since you are an investor, I'd love to for you to share why you decided to invest in Maximus.
I mean, first and foremost, I invested because of you. So I think, Cam, I've known you for a long time. And I think one thing that I've realized with, especially as I've done more and more investing, is that there's literally infinite capital in the world. And I think you see that now with valuations, crypto assets, everything kind of mooning, and then the government's printing out free dollars. So there's capital is there. I think there's actually a lot of great ideas to solve. I mean, clearly there's a lot of problems with our society and our world. Sure. So I think what the limiting reagent is are actual entrepreneurs, founders with high integrity, fearlessness, boldness, and just seeing your academic background, your clinical training, and then that focus and that boldness in terms of like speaking towards masculinity in a way that's unabashed bold, I think was amazing and awesome. So I think first and foremost, I think backing the jockey, it was one of the key reasons here. And then two, I think the problem that you know, we're solving with Maximus is incredibly important. I think, I'm sure through these conversations, just the testosterone, kind of the trend of masculinity in Western civilization is in a very weird, awkward spot. I'm sure we'll cover and unpack that. And having a community, having a telemedicine platform, really addressing and speaking towards those needs seems to be more important than ever. So I think from a founding perspective and the problem set as is, probably one of the top 3, top 5 problems that we as a culture really need to solve.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, I always appreciate the vote of confidence. And now I feel obligated to fulfill that. But you know, it's funny. I remember I've actually been on your podcast twice and I very much appreciate having me as a guest. But the last time I went on, you know, we actually, at the very, very end of it, we were mostly talking about dopamine fasting, but I did start to talk about sort of the masculinity stuff and some of the theses that I was beginning to form. And funnily, you know, we took a little clip of that, threw it on TikTok, and that's by far the most viral clip that actually that talks about there's no such thing as toxic masculinity versus, you know, toxic behaviors. So yeah, it's kind of interesting to see that sort of resonate in the public as well.
Yeah, and I think part of it's like there's some boldness and fearlessness here because at least what I perceive with mainstream culture and mainstream media is that there is such an empowerment for women's equality. And I think those are all very, very great. Sure. But I think where it's very, very potentially going back to the word toxic is that now you can't talk about masculinity and you can't talk about what it means to be a man. And there needs to be a counter pull. There needs to be a strong leaders that actually actively speak out and carve out our own narrative here. I think most people just want to live a happy everyday life and they don't really think about their identity or their masculinity or femininity. I think it's just like people are individuals just living their life. Mm-hmm. And I think there is such a strong push. And in some ways, from a cultural perspective, like a very legitimate cause to try to level the playing field across gender, sexuality, sex, all these attributes that none of us really choose. Mm-hmm. But I think where it goes off the deep end is when you start bashing men. And I think we all know what we're talking about here, where it's like, oh, all men are evil. All men are bastards. It's like, I don't know who you are. I didn't do anything to you.
Sure. Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, certainly we all want a more equal playing field. But yeah, I think sometimes people take that a little bit to the extreme and tilt, quite frankly, the playing field in an unfavorable way. I think the unfortunate thing is, you know, in sort of today's cancel culture, it's very easy to sort of get painted with the what I'll call the ist brush. You're either, you know, sexist or racist or misogynist or transphobic or whatever ist. And those are such powerful labels that obviously will, you know, get you, quite frankly, fired or ostracized in modern society, that we become paranoid, that you cannot speak out against any or speak for, quite frankly, anything that may even remotely move you in that direction. Because the moment someone paints that brush, it's almost like I call it sort of modern McCarthyism, right? Where back in the day, people forget that we went through this history in U.S. culture where, you know, if you didn't like someone, you just called them a communist and they literally couldn't get work in Hollywood. They were literally put on a blacklist. They were unhirable. And we realized that was ridiculous because most of those people weren't communists. They're just people who were whatever competitors or people you didn't like. And as soon as you painted them with that brush, boom, they're gone. And obviously that was very toxic for American society. And we stopped that. And it took a little while. But it's interesting that we're almost like repeating history over and over again. And I think we're doing it not with with communism, but with the ist labels, unfortunately.
100%. And I think, again, just having conversations with folks on that side of house, I think they're trying to do well. I think they're trying to do good. I think a lot of their efforts, unfortunately, are misguided. And then too, this is not even talking about the biological problem that I think, you know, you're leading the way on. And I think we're just seeing within the community, testosterone is just dropping year after year after year after year. And you know, our average grandfather was just like had much more testosterone or male sex hormone than us. And just like, no one's really talking about it or even thinks it's even a problem. I think some would even say, oh, that's actually a good thing. We need less testosterone in the world. And it's like, let's hold on and like, let's break that down from just like a physiological, biological perspective, let alone the social cultural implications.
Right, right. Yeah, I think it's very misguided because people associate testosterone with aggression, which is not necessarily true. In fact, we know from actually like testosterone studies where they like, you know, increased it, it actually has like a calming influence on people. So it's actually the opposite. So yeah, I think there's sort of a misunderstanding of physiology that happens, but I think also people forget. I think you're right. Like people just, for the most part, they're trying to live their lives, be healthy and happy people. I think they sort of don't maybe realize what they're missing out on, right? Because if that's sort of whether physiologically or psychologically what you grew up with, you don't really know better. I'll give you a great example of this. I posted a video on Twitter. It was like filming a high school in the 1990s, probably somewhere in Southern California. And it was such a remarkable stark difference to like modern schools. Like everyone had great posture. Everyone was smiling and happy. Nobody was like looking down on their phones. There was like a very like genuine expression of affect. And maybe it's like, okay, you're looking back and being like super nostalgic about those days. But it was funny. People like literally commented and they're like, I grew up past that era and like schools don't look like that anymore. And I don't even know what I missed. And I was like, yeah, you kind of did miss out because I literally didn't have a cell phone until I graduated from high school. And I think it was a good thing. Like it allowed my brain to develop normally. Thank goodness. Now I've probably ruined it with excessive use. But I think that's true for testosterone too. I was actually reviewing the literature yesterday and the specifically the research studies, right? It's been going down Yeah, if you look at bioavailable testosterone, it's been going down 1.3% a year, which basically means over the span of 50 years, it's gone down 65%, right? So you don't know that because you're like, you feel the way that you feel. But if you compare it to your father or your grandfather, 65% is actually like a pretty significant difference. Same thing with sperm count and sperm quality has gone down 58% over the last 50 years. So, which you're not aware of until you actually try having kids. And you know, a lot of guys, not particularly old, like late 20s, early 30s, are running into fertility problems where they're not producing enough sperm to, you know, get their significant other pregnant. Other interesting statistic, like guys are literally getting weaker. And this was only in the span of 30 years. I think they compared, it was like 1985. Guys in 1985 who were young, kind of between the ages of 20 and 34, I believe, to guys in 2015, like their grip strength in terms of the pounds of pressure or force went down from like 118 pounds to like 95 pounds. So like a 16% drop in grip strength. And then finally, I think one that we might have talked about is even the perception of masculinity has gone down. If you ask guys who are over the age of 65, 82% of them consider themselves highly masculine, right? A 5 or 6 out of a 6-point scale. If you ask guys who are 18 to 29, so the younger generation now, which I guess we call Gen Z, only 48% consider themselves highly masculine. So it's literally the first time in American history where the masculine male is in the minority. And that's literally changed in one generation, right? So I think people like don't realize that, right? So if you've been around long enough, you see like guys, masculinity, even society and culture literally looked and felt different in one generation, and now it's totally different. And I think we just have like myopia or forgetfulness about that, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we should unpack this a little bit more, because I would say that the counter argument is that, again, going back to toxic masculinity, hey, is this a good thing? Mm-hmm. We're not just having a patriarchal society anymore. You know, essentially we're feminizing men, where traditional masculine traits are like not productive for like a healthy, happy society. And I think I'm curious to hear your thoughts here, but for me, it's, again, not trying to oppress any other group of people, but I think is it a social cultural phenomenon, or is it actually a biological exogenous chemical problem,
yeah,
right? That is like seeping into and then altering our actual culture in a way that we don't actually perceive. Totally. Like that is what I think is like the scary side effect. And I think it's not because I'm like a crazy conspiracy theorist, but there are just like literally actual case studies where if you have, you know, phthalates and these chemicals in a pond, all the frogs in that pond turn into women or female frogs.
Right.
And is that happening in a very slow way in modern human society? And is that actually affecting our politics, our culture, our society in a way that we don't actually perceive? And I think that is getting to like a very interesting, potentially cancelable like territory where it's like, you know, is this directionally something that we as a society are quote unquote modernizing and leveling the playing field in terms of androgenizing? Or I feel like there's like this interesting path where like there's kind of like a everyone's getting like kind of pushed towards the same mold where like right. Men are becoming more female-like, and then there's a lot of female empowerment where they become more masculine.
Right.
It's unclear if everyone is happy because of these changes.
Yeah.
And again, I think a lot of these social cultural phenomenons are unclear if it's culturally driven, biologically, environmentally driven, a mix of both. And are these like reasonable things to even like consider? Like,
right.
It is not like an open discussion about this stuff.
Yeah. And I think it's important to unpack to your point. Let's separate the physiology from the psychology as much as we can, at least for the time being. I don't think anyone can legitimately argue the physiological declines that we're seeing are healthy by any stretch of the imagination, right? Because literally fertility is one of the best proxies for the health of any species, right? For instance, the sperm count decline has been so drastic and linear that the author who in fact published this work, I believe is a medical school professor at Mount Sinai, and literally calculated that if the trend continues, we're going to hit sperm count zero by 2045, right? So, and like maybe as a species, we literally lose our ability to reproduce. So I was like, clearly we don't want that trend to continue because our viability as a human species is out the door. So dropping testosterone and sperm is obviously terrible. I don't know anyone who in their right mind would argue that's a good thing. I do think it is a clear phenomenon because it's not just in humans. We've literally seen the same phenomenon in dogs, right? So literally man's best friend is similar drop in sperm count, which suggests that it's an environmental factor, right? You alluded to phthalates, BPA, a lot of people are familiar with because it's in plastics, and especially a lot of these PFASs, these non-stick chemicals that are in like your non-stick pans and clothes and like water resistant things, flame resistant things. We put all these chemicals for a certain purpose. We didn't realize like they're endocrine disrupting, right? Another great example is receipts. Like literally like your receipts are coated in BPA and you might think, like not a big deal, but there's literally studies that show that like touching receipts, like within that same day, you can measure the amount of BPA in your blood, right? Like it literally see, it's a great, the skin is a great transmission vehicle. And so, you know, all of those things, you know, it sounds very conspiracy theory, but you know, it's the same thing with Erin Brockovich. If you ever watched that movie, you know, everyone thought she was a conspiracy theorist in terms of like toxic mold and stuff until she did all the research and showed that was like a big thing. Ironically, she's the same person now that's like drumming the siren call around these toxic sort of endocrine disrupting chemicals. There's just a big publication she put out about like, this is the next big crisis, in fact. Now, to your point, like, does this affecting our psychology? For instance, is the drop in perceived masculinity because of the physiological decline, or is it because of sort of social cultural mores? That I don't think we don't know. But I think most plausibly, it's probably a combination of both. Like, clearly your amount of testosterone, your virility, whether or not you want to have kids, does affect you psychologically. So I have no doubt that, and we know this too, because, you know, like if you ask guys who are low versus high testosterone and you change their amount of testosterone, it does kind of change their self-perception and the way that they feel. But yeah, in a society where masculinity is a bad word or maybe not as encouraged and maybe androgyny is more promoted, I'm sure there's social and cultural pressures too. And I think that's why, you know, I care about both sides. Like, you know, I think we need to restore our birthright and everyone needs to go back to hopefully a baseline that their father or grandfather had in terms of their testosterone and virility, because obviously we want healthy reproduction. But I also think psychologically too, if we almost reclaim masculinity, I don't think it actually needs to be redefined. Masculinity, and I've said femininity as well, in their traditional forms are virtuous things, and if they're obviously expressed in a positive and healthy way. So hopefully we can address both of these things and like return to a reproductive health and sanity, as I like to say.
100%.
So why don't we actually this is a great conversation. We should continue talking about it, but I love to kind of focus a little bit on you and understand your journey. I'd love to hear it. Like, tell me a little bit about where you grew up, what your upbringing was like.
Yeah, I'm a California kid my entire life. So grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles called Palos Verdes. Mm-hmm. Probably the coolest part of our high school was that Pete Sampras played on our tennis team back in his day. I was a tennis player growing up, so all his high school championship plaques are all over our walls. Mm-hmm. Played tennis, but was really a math science nerd. So did the math Olympiads, did the science fairs, was very interested in physics and computer science. So I would say very happy childhood, although had kind of the American dream immigrant chip on the block. So my dad came to America from Hong Kong to study physics. He was doing his PhD in physics before dropping out and pursuing his entrepreneurial journey. My mom came out of the Cultural Revolution of China and then moved to America. So in some sense, like now looking back and like more fully understanding my history and my family's history, mm-hmm. Very much appreciative of the opportunity of being able to, you know, join, you know, merge, assimilate culture from kind of the upbringings that my parents and grandparents had in terms of, you know, that I think the focus on academics, the focus on hard work, the focus on, and having that rub into like having a little bit of a chip on the shoulder, mm-hmm. and having to, I think a little bit more clearly about self-identity, versus someone that's like classic Americana American who, you know, was like the kind of the quote unquote default American.
Right.
But I think having that self-exploration, self-journey is, I think, just makes me and I think most people more robust because they've had to be thoughtful about it. And in fact, I would say that like, even me, like I consider myself American first and foremost, but I feel like immigrants that move to America are like the best Americans because they actually have to make a decision. Like I didn't choose to be American or not. I'm like, I feel super fortunate to be American.
Right.
But when I just like talk to like a number of people, you know, just across my personal journey here, I think the best Americans are like immigrants because they like truly know what it's like. And having the opportunity to work with contractors, employees internationally, and then in more recent years, being able to work with U.S. military members, athletes that represent America in the Olympics, meet and work with veterans and people that have like literally shed blood for our country, have gotten to understand America in a lot deeper way. We can talk a little bit more of that through this conversation. But yeah, I mean, I would say that overall, just like have a very fortunate childhood where I saw my family build wealth, build success, network into different circles. And again, just very, very like happy, lucky childhood. Was able to do well in school. I think I was always good at multiple choice tests. So I think my like kind of awkward brag, humble brag, not really humble brag, was I was the highest scoring SAT student in eighth grade. I scored a 1590 out of 1600 as an eighth grader. The 10 points was actually, I messed up a math question. I was always like a big voracious reader.
Yeah.
I'd read like these like military World War II history books when I was like 5, 6, 7. Mm-hmm. Just like would like crush the like the reading. I don't know if you had like a local library, but there was like always like summer of reading and you like get like stickers or some like dubious prizes for like reading the most books. And I would just like read and crush like hundreds of books. But anyways, ended up going to Stanford, studying computer science, and then really diving deep into the entrepreneurship community. I think was a very interesting time in Silicon Valley, in the Bay Area. So I went to college between 2007 and 2011.
Right.
And I remember when I was entering freshman year, computer science was super hardcore and nerdy, right? It was just like hardcore nerds that were like IOI Olympiad winners and like kids have been programmed since they're like 7.
Yeah.
Were the CS people. And then I think that the switching point was actually the Social Network movie.
Mm.
When the Facebook movie dropped, and people were starting to make a lot of money doing startups because the Instagram co-founders were a couple years older than us. Evan Spiegel at Snapchat was like a year younger than me.
Yeah.
So like it was right in that era where like computer science became like the coolest thing ever. And like everyone became a computer scientist. So it was interesting to be at that point, just seeing that transition. And then also being a little bit on the earlier side of that, seeing that shift in interest, shift in economic value, where people were very focused on being pre-med mm-hmm. or investment bankers or consultants,
right.
Going to startups. And then again, being on the earlier side, being a little bit quicker. So I was able to, you know, meet VCs, talk to entrepreneurs as a college student, which helped orient me towards saying that, hey, startup stuff is like possible.
Totally.
And again, I think it's very, very, again, fortunate to actually see that this is a possible path, because I think there's so many people that are smart, have ambition, but just like don't have any templates or any roadmap to even
right.
see what is, how to even accomplish these things. So again, very lucky to have an opportunity as was a graduating senior to either do a PhD in computer science at Princeton, join Facebook, or Y Combinator was going to give us like $170,000 at the time. With me, to me and two of my college buddies to start a company.
Nice.
And at the time, $170,000, it was like
a lot of money.
money for like a broke college kid.
I had a question for you about this, because you mentioned sort of the chip on your shoulder, obviously you kind of, you know, your background. Did you ever feel a pressure to take a safer path, right? Because to your point, like, especially if you kind of come from, you know, a more conservative you know, family culture, international background, the expectation is to be pre-med, go into more traditional finance, or get a PhD and go to grad school. And how did you sort of, if you did or if you didn't, how did you sort of balance those competing interests with taking more risk and going, obviously, the more entrepreneurial route?
So my dad took the entrepreneurial route. So he was very, very early on the globalization trend, meaning that as the Chinese market was opening up, there was just like a lot of opportunity to do import export through Hong Kong. So he got into the toy and, you know, seasonal goods and Halloween costume business back in like the 70s, right? So he was like one of the early movers in that space. So he was able to build a, you know, very successful business. And so I think just like seeing that like starting a company, you know, having employees, having warehouses, mm-hmm. you know, meeting local politicians and becoming like a member of quote unquote respected community member right. was possible. Mm. And again, it's just like, there's nothing I did. It was just like, I just saw my dad like move well.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, like, that was interesting. And I think through that lens, it was like, oh, like he goes hires lawyers. He hires, you know, these professional industry members where I think the classic immigrant path is like, get the stable postgraduate degree, get this professional job. That degree will always give you a income stream. Just seeing a little bit about the other side. Okay, like if you actually are on the entrepreneurial side, you hire these people to work for you.
Yeah.
So I think it was always possible. It's like, oh, okay, like that's just normal. Again, it was like normal to me because like that was what my dad did.
Totally.
So I had much less pressure there. I think there was always like both either internal competitiveness or just an expectation from my parents to like just generally do well. But I think I was kind of lucky that, you know, I was, again, good at math competitions, good at science fairs. I think that's partly, you know, how I, you know, I think, you know, I know you had like, you know, went to Harvard and had like reasonable academic track record, right? Like you have to like win some stuff, sure, do sure. somewhat well within like high school to make a top tier college. So I think with that said, right, like there wasn't that much kind of exogenous pressure because like, you know, we were hitting our marks.
And you sound really self-motivated. Most people are not reading, no matter how many stickers or pizza they're getting, like a significant amount of novels at the age of 5, 6, or 7. So it sounds like it was
I remember reading Ender's Game when I was 5. It was like the exactly. dopest book.
So I think it's a combination of both an individual and environment. And that obviously set you up very well. So I'm kind of curious at this key inflection point, right? You're graduating Stanford with honors. You kind of have the world at your fingertips. You have a lot of different options, right? Including, you know, grad school, YC. So how do you sort of make that decision? And how did that kind of lead to your next steps?
Yeah, I wish it was more thoughtful and it was not that thoughtful. So in some sense, but I think I remember at the time, it literally put like, this was a free roll. Mm-hmm. Like I had a chance to work with a couple of my best friends from, you know, one was an electrical engineer. One was a top computer science friend. They're all doing great things now. And I was like, hey, we have like quote unquote, like infinite money at the time to like build a startup. I felt like I could always go back to school. I felt like I could always get a job. So in that sense, it was a path of least resistance to be entrepreneurial. So I wish it was like, hey, I had like this master plan and we were super well thought out in terms of our business idea. But it wasn't. I think honestly it was having enough of a baseline safety net where taking kind of a risk on a lark did not have like a crazy downside. So I think that was a calculation. Like there was no like master vision, master plan that was like super, super thoughtful. But at least I was sensible enough to say like, hey, like the downside risk is actually quite low and it'd probably be fun.
Yeah.
So we took a shot.
I love it. And tell us about.
So it's mainly just like taking a shot.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I think the combination of like, you know, understanding sort of risk, which I think actually people underappreciate, right? They always see sort of the downside. They don't necessarily see the opportunity cost oftentimes of staying or see the tremendous upside. And I think decatastrophizing to your point, which is like, Not everyone is always in the same position, and maybe there is the greater consequences. But at least one thing that's great about America, bankruptcy laws, et cetera, there's not a huge price for failure as there are in certainly in other places. So I think that makes sense in terms of your entrepreneurial sort of kickstarting that path. And then tell us a little bit about that company and how that turned out.
Yeah, so that was a company that ended up being called GlassMap. And the original idea stemmed from me and one of my co-founders, John. We went to the Orange Bowl in now my new home in Florida. I recently moved. We can talk a little bit more of that as well. But yeah, we were just like lost in Florida, and it was like, hey, this is right when the iPhone came out, when location services were like really, really poor.
Right.
I just wanted to see, like, find my friends, like, didn't really exist. That's like a very, very common use case now. Yeah, we just wanted to like link up, and we thought, hey, why don't we make a Marauder's map from Harry Potter, like the magical map where you could see all your friends for college campuses. Mm-hmm. And the first version was really, really battery inefficient. We just realized that, like, oh, this is why this doesn't exist, because this like kills your battery.
Yeah.
So we actually figured out a really, really clever way to make a very battery efficient, a power efficient way to mimic real time movements on a map. So we actually built our own voice over IP server to actually create a pull model for getting location from people versus a push model. So like the original way you could only do this is like upload your location every like 2 minutes, every 5 minutes, a very dumb, naive, battery efficient way to do that. And we figured a way to do it from a demand generation or a pull perspective. And we actually, that algorithm was actually patented. Which was like, I think, you know, one of my first patents.
Cool.
It was a very, very cool entrepreneurial journey. I mean, we got into Y Combinator back in 2011 when it was still very, very, early, right? Like now it's like kind of an institution, like a legend in the space, but like a lot of these characters that are now like luminaries were just kind of starting off, right? Like, yeah. Like Sam Altman was like a part-time partner at the time, right? Like Gary Tan's official title at Y Combinator was designer in residence. He wasn't even like an investing partner at the time. Like Paul Graham was like making chili for people. So I just got to see like kind of the OG days of some of these like luminaries in venture capital. It was a very quick lesson in like the ups and downs of startups. So when we first launched, Facebook actually wanted to buy us because we had the best algorithms in the space. There were some other competitors. If you might remember, there was a company called Highlight, which was also started by the CEO of Clubhouse, which is doing, you know, phenomenally well. He was doing a local social location thing. And there's other people in the space. And I think Facebook realized that we had the best algorithms. So, you know, we were like playing around, and I think one of the coolest stories is that, you know, we came and saw Mark Zuckerberg at their new campus, got the kind of walking tour. One of my co-founders just like hated Facebook and like just would not want to sell to Facebook. I'm like, and we're like, oh, we just launched, like we should probably ride this out. Like my dream was not to, you know, just like I'm sure you're in the same boat. Your dream is not to sell this thing in like 2 months. Your dream is to build something durable and actually see this thing through. So while the acquisition offer was like quite attractive, being like 23 or something, we had big dreams.
Yeah.
And then obviously like things were not like crazy rocket shipping, because I think it's very, very hard to launch a consumer app.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're kind of growing linearly, not exponentially. We realized that, you know, potentially we could take our algorithm and use it for more of a business, small business marketing, advertising platform. Got some early traction there, and eventually sold the company to Groupon, where we became part of the core team building out what they were at the time called the Merchant OS, or we were building like some of the experimental like wallet point of sale infrastructure for Groupon. But I think that like the core lesson there is that, you know, seeing how hard it is to actually build something of value, actually selling to real customers, rather than just like, you know, what would have been like a Cinderella story, or like you graduate college, you make a product with your best friends, you get some money, then like one of the coolest CEOs in the world just like wants to buy you and you become a millionaire in like 6 months. Like I think from that experience and like not doing that, struggling and like trying to like create something of value was a very helpful learning experience to not be arrogant. Not everything's gonna be handed to you. You gotta like fight and earn what you get. And realize it's like, this is just challenging to make us like an actual real business was like very, very helpful for me as I turned 24 going through and selling the company to Groupon.
Totally. Yeah. You know, it's funny to hear your stories about like the old school YC days, which I'm sure a lot of people appreciate with like Sam, Gary and Paul. Because I had a similar kind of experience. Like Mark Zuckerberg was literally my classmate at Harvard. And so I remember him as like t-shirt and hoodie Mark, not like, you know, the guy who's like testifying before Congress and like buying companies or making at least acquisition offers for companies like yours. But I think it is actually, it's useful to reflect upon that, right? We sort of apotheosize or glorify all these people as, and maybe professionally it makes sense. Like they are very successful and wise, but they're also people. And that also means that like, it's possible for you too, quite frankly, to do great things. You know, who knows, to varying degrees of success. But I think when we're fortunate enough, like you and me, to be in touch with people like that, I think it extends the realm of possibility much more than people who aren't. And it doesn't become just like a mythical thing. You're like, oh, okay. Like if they can do it, I can do it too. Yep. And I wish more people had that opportunity. You don't need to go to Harvard or Stanford, by the way, to do that. I think just listening to podcasts like ours and, you know, mine and yours, it puts you in close touch with it. And I think that's the beauty of technology, right? Is it connects you with people, and you can learn from these role models sort of remotely and get inspired to do great things.
Yeah, 100%, Cam. I think that's what I realized. It's simultaneously humbling because wow, like these people have created so much value, but also it's like it's also like confidence building because like you realize that, man, like these guys are not 100 million times smarter than you or me. You know what I mean? It's like they're pretty damn smart and they're pretty damn hardworking and made some good plays, but they're absolutely not aliens that are like an order of magnitude smarter than like every other person that I meet. So that's where it's like simultaneously humbling and also confidence boosting where it's like possible.
Totally, totally. And then I'm really curious because I feel like with your background, you know, like brilliant at math and physics, you went to Stanford, studied computer science, created kind of a social startup. You're kind of heading in the Evan Spiegel direction of things. And then, you know, I think I met you very early on in your journey at Human. And, you know, with your next company, you take sort of a very different direction as opposed to like a pure sort of software play app. You know, you kind of go into the nootropic and nutrition and metabolic realm, which is not typical for someone who's like a pure STEM CS kind of person. So I'd love to hear your kind of personal interest and journey in getting interested in health and creating a health company.
Yeah, I think in some ways it feels like out of left field, but I think it's been, at least in my internal narrative, is very consistent in terms of just seeking self-improvement. Mm. I think it very much came from a self-centered, egocentric, like, hey, I want to be even more competitive in this like very competitive economic warfare environment of Silicon Valley. How do I like extract every single edge? That like humbly was like how I even got interested in human performance and biohacking and all of this stuff. And it started off as a hobby, like, hey, this is kind of interesting. Let me play around with different research chemicals. Like, oh, like there's this Russian Alzheimer's drugs that people on Reddit were talking about. Like, I'm kind of intrigued. This is not super well studied in humans. Maybe I should like try it. Maybe it's, you know, some of our friends were like ordering this stuff. And this is like through Alibaba, through like some weird Indian and Chinese manufacturers. And I think it was like, one, simultaneously like kind of scary that like we're just getting bags of white powder from like random vendors. But then two, also that like there was some stuff that was like completely like had no data on, some that had like a little bit more reasonable animal data on, some that even had some human data on. But I think the three was that, like, a lot of people are interested in this stuff, especially circa like 2014, 2015, right? So like, if you remember, or folks that are listening might remember, there were a lot of like articles about like smart drugs, Silicon Valley, like a lot of that like kind of interest was just happening kind of organic in the community. So one, I thought it was interesting from a personal perspective. And then two, what made it interesting from like an entrepreneurial perspective was that I quickly realized that I wanted to just like understand what was consuming and wanting to make sure it was safe. It was, you know, fully buttoned up in terms of regulatory and legal. And then three, just like choose the best possible components out there, right? Because you know, people go from talking about microdosing, schedule one drugs, all the way towards like research chemicals, all the way towards like very, very legal, safe, well understood, things that could be considered nootropics. And like that's whole Wild West was out there. Why didn't something exist to make it easy for me to just like click and buy this stuff online?
Totally.
So as a CS guy, just was able to build up a little landing page and start tracking interest. And I remember when we had the landing page up, like a pre-sales page, I had 37 orders for $1,000 of revenue. And I was like, huh, okay, like some people want this stuff.
Right.
And I got to figure out how to like fulfill them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like the original little start. And 8 months fast forward, we were doing about $80,000 a month of revenue.
Amazing.
And I was like, damn, this is like a kind of a real business now. I got to like figure out how to like do it properly. And that's where we were able to pull in some, you know, friends and family to help us build out a little bit of infrastructure with a little bit of seed capital, and eventually got Andreessen Horowitz, you know, involved and right. off to the races.
Yeah. And Chris Dixon is your lead investor, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And just to set the stage, because I feel like you're actually undervaluing what you're doing. You know, back in the day, like the whole concept of smart drugs basically did not really exist. Like if you wanted to enhance your cognition, there really wasn't a lot of options. Maybe you'd go see a psychiatrist if you had ADHD and could get some stimulant medications, but there really wasn't much out there. And I think with the whole internet revolution happened, first of all, like anyone anywhere in the world had access to research articles, which became amazing, right? So you could understand like what is the latest and greatest that's in the pipeline for, you know, improving cognitive function, reducing dementia, Alzheimer's, et cetera. And so like any university student at a college campus had access to full research articles, which was amazing. Second, like the whole Reddit and discussion forum revolution happened, right? Where people can now talk about these things and almost teach each other about, you know, the latest and greatest, which I still do. I still read our nootropic because I'm like, I want to know what the latest and greatest is out there. And then third, yeah, to your point, you know, Alibaba and these, you know, online resources made it available that you could literally go talk to biotech companies and literally import some of this. But it was very much a Wild West, right? And it seemed kind of skeezy or unsafe. And so I think what, you know, there was clearly a huge interest in people enhancing their function, right? Whether cognitive, physiological, et cetera. But how do you do that in a way where it is really upholding of the science, which I think you guys do a great job of doing in terms of like making sure everything that you put out is evidence-based and even doing your own research, which very few companies do. And then, you know, making sure everything is like top quality, generally recognized as safe, manufactured to the highest standards. So I think in a lot of ways, you kind of took like a subculture, right? Which is like this sort of biohacking nootropics and made it really available, safe and accessible to the masses for a much broader population than the nerds like you and I.
100%. I mean, I think that's just, you know, kind of the Silicon Valley thesis is that some weird niches and subcommunities oftentimes lead what culture looks like in the future. So hopefully, I think it's still very, very early innings. And I think we've just like from that initial seed in terms of nootropics, expanded out to metabolic health, exogenous ketones.
Yeah, I wanted to ask specifically about that because you started out really as a nootropics company. I remember the Go Cubes, you had little, you know, caffeine cubes and it was all around sort of smart drugs, which you still continue to have. But I know you came across sort of these exogenous ketones. Yep. Keto started blowing up. And, you know, I had a keto company, which I talked about on one of your podcasts. So and you kind of rebranded as kind of like a you changed the name of the company, kind of broadened the focus of metabolic health. Tell me a little bit about that kind of slight pivot that you've had and why you started really getting interested in sort of nutrition and metabolism.
So this is probably circa 2015, 2016. A lot of the intermittent fasting literature was starting to become published around its implications, not just for metabolic health, potentially longevity markers, but also for neurogenesis, right? The growth of new neurons. And that was, you know, a key reason why you would even consider nootropics in the first place. So, we started as a company hosting these intermittent fasting breakfasts. So we would, you know, as a company, we went kind of like crazy. I remember we got like a lot of press for this,
but
do Sunday night, we would have our last meal and then break fast together Wednesday morning. And we would just do it as a company, but then our community members are like people, our customers wanted to join in with us. And this We Fast intermittent fasting community kind of went viral, and we have, I don't know, at this point, like 20,000 plus members across like our Slack and Facebook groups, all fasting together. And our initial entry point was cognitive neurogenesis and potentially like, you know, enjoying some of the potential longevity benefits, at least from metabolic health biomarkers, right? Like, I want to just caveat that, you know, no one has done human longitudinal studies on any of this stuff. It's just too hard to run RCTs on human longevity. But I think in terms of like the animal data, the biomarker data, very, very promising. Something that like, if I had to take a bet, I'd be like, yeah, this is probably good for longevity. So that like just opened up a new purview into metabolism. Seems to be a much more primal problem than just something a little bit more downstream in the brain. And I think what we realize is that just from like a core, like how can we solve larger and larger problems, this seemed to be a much deeper primal problem than just cognitive performance alone. Because if you can solve for a healthy metabolism, and now if you look at just the numbers, right? Like I think there's something that, you know, we talk a lot about 80% of Americans have metabolic dysfunction, 75% are overweight, obese, Alzheimer's going up, diabetes going up, pre-diabetes, you know, a third of Americans are pre-diabetic or diabetic. Going back to one of your points, like early on the top of the conversation, I've had an opportunity to work with military, and like you talked to the Surgeon General, it's like, yeah, like people can't pass boot camp anymore because they just break their bones. Everyone's just like weak. So that seemed like just a much more of a more universal problem than making like Stanford, Harvard computer scientists and like Silicon Valley engineers like 2%, 1%, 5% better. Can we do something more impactful that stem from our core desire to just be better versions of ourselves? So that was like kind of core instinct one. And then two, I think the way I always think about, like, I think the narrative we tell ourselves at least is that so many of the smartest people are working on making computers and robots better, right? Like I'm sure a lot of your friends are, you know, running very successful advertising companies or like social, you know, app companies, and you and I are choosing to make better humans. And I feel like it's like a more fundamentally, more primally important problem because, hey, humans aren't doing that are doing okay, but not doing that great.
That's right. Robots are getting smarter and faster and we're getting slower and dumber.
Yeah. So it's like, hey, we should just build, we should lead the charge for humanity here. So that, that kind of pivoted us towards the broader mandate around metabolic health. And then what like really, really turbocharged a lot of the push was seeing a lot of the research around exogenous ketones or ketone esters, essentially inducing ketosis really, really rapidly through an exogenous chemical or a food, which is like very, very interesting because typically to get into ketosis requires a very, very strict ketogenic diet or intermittent fasting. And if there could be a third lever where you could actually consume ketones as an exogenous food, what could that mean from both a research perspective, a performance perspective, and potentially like a health span, lifespan perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember, you know, when you guys got the exclusive patent on this exogenous ketone and got a lot of publicity, it's sort of like the fourth macronutrient, right? Yep. Which I thought was very big and very innovative, right? For a company to do. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about this. I know a lot of, for instance, the professional Tour de France cyclists were literally using your product to have a competitive edge and win. So I love, and obviously military, Navy SEALs, et cetera. So talk a little bit about that. Like, how does it enhance performance? And also, how does that apply to like the everyday folk, right? If you're not a professional athlete or Navy SEAL, how does it benefit you?
Yep. So what is ketosis? So ketosis is essentially requires some sort of carbohydrate restriction. So it forces your body, after it kind of runs out of its sugar stores, to start converting its fat stores into what are called ketones, ketone bodies. And this was actually originally an evolutionary survival mechanism for mammals with large brains. Mm. Sugar crosses a blood-brain barrier, so your neurons can use sugar and we can be smart. Fatty acids are large molecules, does not cross the blood-brain barrier. Mm-hmm. So what happens for like, you know, big mammals like us with big brains? Do we just go brain dead because we can't feel ourselves after, you know, 24 hours of carbohydrate restriction? Fortunately, we have a backup mechanism called ketosis. Mm-hmm. So fatty acids convert into ketones. Ketones are across the blood-brain barrier. We can be sharp and productive and all of these great things. So that is what ketosis is. And it's been studied and around for a long time. Originally, it was used as a nutritional therapeutic for epilepsy, right? Because like it was a very efficient fuel for the brain. And then it kind of got forgotten for the last 100 years. And now I think the ketogenic research is really exploding, where there's so many potential endpoints that ketosis could be helpful for, ranging from metabolic syndrome all the way towards cognitive performance to now like, you know, enhancing physical performance. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like the quick 101 on what ketosis even is. I think most people probably have heard of ketosis through like a ketogenic diet. Kim Kardashian, some celebrities are, you know, quite vocal about these keto diets for rapid weight loss, which, you know, actually reasonably works, because if you are forcing your metabolism to burn fat, its fat stores, that's like a very reasonable way to drop body or improve body composition. Mm-hmm. So that's probably like the popular buzz within the last 5 years of why people have heard of the ketogenic diet, for body comp and weight loss. But I think the implications are much more primal, right? It's like it's a very ancient form of metabolism that we really rarely go into as a species anymore, because there's so much carbohydrate availability when we're eating hyper processed snack, high carb foods. So the original paradigm is that now, okay, you have either carbohydrate metabolism or more of a ketogenic metabolism, and you really had to make a choice, right? You had to either have high carbs and therefore not a lot of ketogenesis or creation of ketones, or you could just eat keto and then have ketones in your system, but not really have carbohydrates in your system. Right. So if you could introduce an exogenous food form of ketones that you could actually consume as a beverage or a food, now you could have this novel paradigm or this novel state where you can have high carbohydrate and high ketones at the same exact time.
Best of both worlds.
Yes. So that's where we're seeing performance implications for athletes. So as you mentioned, we're like the top supplier for Tour de France teams as endurance fuel for basically the who's who of cycling. I think a lot of interesting customers ranging from big names like Conor McGregor, a recent friend, Jake Paul, is big on ketones. So I think it's been very, very interesting to tap into that side of the world, like Lance Armstrong, Apollo Ohno, just like really, really cool athletes. from the performance side, we've just gotten to know through the kind of the ketones as a enhancement perspective. And obviously there's some military implications for that, but I think just for like the general daily use is that, you know, again, this is like an open area of research, but you know, like the hypothesis here is that it is likely beneficial to get into ketosis periodically. Mm-hmm. This is just like a hypothesis that I'm going to put out there. And it's like my hypothesis, just like a generally like thesis within the ketogenic community that this was an ancestral metabolic state that ancient humans have gotten back into, right? Through feast and famine cycles. Yep. You don't have constant availability of food. It's likely beneficial to cycle through all of your stored fat, stored glycogen, recycle all of that as you're able to like actually take down an animal. This seems to be a relatively reasonable, ancestrally consistent thing to do.
Totally. My favorite Michael Porfirio tweet, by the way, is he's like, a failed hunt is the original intermittent fast, basically, because you don't eat.
Yeah, and I think that's like very, very consistent with what we observe in nature, right? Like cheetahs and lions and tigers, they don't take down food every single day. It's hard. It's a hard world. So from a technology perspective, we see that having a way to mimic the presence of ketones without having to be super disciplined as a very interesting way, as like a very, very like accessible baseline, right? Can you mimic some of the benefits of ketones without having to be disciplined? And I think stage two is like, can we help bridge people into a more ketogenic state? Oftentimes it's very, very hard for people that are essentially insulin carbohydrate dependent to switch into more of a low carb state. People feel hangry, people feel a keto flu. If you can have a ketone ester or exogenous ketone to help bridge that that kind of swap from carbohydrate-based metabolism to ketogenic-based metabolism, make it easier by having exogenous ketones like bridge an energy deficit, that might be a helpful tool. So, I mean, long-term vision, I think, goes back to like, you know, kind of our, you know, a thesis that like, hey, we think ketones as a fourth macronutrient, where you have protein, fat, carbohydrate. These are the calorie-containing substrates within all of our foods. What if you had a fourth calorie-containing macronutrient that adds a different metabolic effect? And that's pretty interesting from a food and nutrition world, that you can have ketones provide calorie in a way that's very, very quick and efficient.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the way that I got really interested in it was with my first company, Omada Health. You know, we were really focused on helping people with prediabetes avoid type 2 diabetes. And I think the research literature convincingly and increasingly supports the notion of low carb / ketogenic diets as honestly the first line treatment for both type 1 and actually type 2 diabetes, in that it's not only probably the best weight loss diet, it's not the only way you can lose weight, but it's certainly superior to low fat diets, but also in terms of improving insulin resistance and metabolic health, it's particularly helpful. What I'm also particularly interested in, and I would, by the way, when I was on doing strict ketogenic diets, would use, you know, ketones, MCT, C8, some of the products, in fact, that you sell, which are incredibly high quality, by the way. I encourage anyone who's interested in exploring this, check out your website. It's hvmn.com. I'm biased because we're kind of friends and business partners as well, but I can objectively say, both as a consumer and as a scientist, the quality of your products that you put out is phenomenal, and even the formulations taste great. Really, really the best stuff on the market. I found it very, very helpful as a pre-workout. So I would literally take these when I work out, because otherwise, you know, without carbohydrates, doing more anaerobic high intensity lifting would be tough without the carbs. But it really kind of smoothed things out and provided energy. So I found it tremendously helpful for that reason. And then the other area that I really think is emerging, exciting, we still need more research to be done, is the cognitive benefits of it. There's some early research that shows that not just for the folks that have epilepsy in terms of reducing their seizures, but can you, to your point, like enhance cognitive function, reduce anxiety? So I'm really interested in, as a mental health treatment, can we use it? Because it's really hard to get someone who's already like depressed and anxious to be on a very strict ketogenic diet. Like, motivation is not high when you're not feeling good. But if it's just like a drink that you can have or a supplement that you can add to someone's diet and, you know, increase their blood ketone levels and make them, you know, feel better and function better, then I think that's a very promising alternative to just the sort of neurotransmitter agonists that we've been pushing sort of in psychiatry.
100%. 100%.